Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Please consider supporting Black Women United YEG for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. You can learn more about them at bwunited.ca. They are always looking for donations and volunteers. So please, again, support Black Women United YEG for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. Again, that website is bwunited.ca.
Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and I live in Wichita, Kansas. I am a Patreon supporter for Creative Control. I discovered Creative Control some years ago, I think maybe while looking for interviews with Tommy Stinson of The Replacements. And I stumbled across this conversation that Vish had with Tommy Stinson that was really insightful. Vish held his own. I think Tommy can be a little bit of a difficult interview at times. And it went really well, and it really got into some areas that I wasn't expecting. And I thought, gosh, I have to listen to more of this guy and his podcast. Yeah, sometimes I'm not necessarily a fan of the music or musicians that Vish will have on the show, but I always appreciate their creative process a little bit more. And more times than not, though, it does lead me to finding a new musical artist that I'm interested in, or to think a little bit differently about maybe some artists whose work I've overlooked. So, you know, go ahead, and if you've been waiting at all to support Vish and Creative Control, now is probably the best time to do it. I know as a public radio employee here in Kansas, listener-supported broadcasting, whether it's podcasts or radio itself, really isn't a thing of the past. It's actually very much a thing of both the present and the future. So, yay Vish, yay Creative Control.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today.
People of Brooklyn, please welcome the most famous Hari Kondabolu in the world, Hari Kondabolu!
Creative Control with Vish Kanak.
Hari Kondabolu is a gifted comedian, incisive writer, hard-touring stand-up, and influential filmmaker based in Brooklyn, New York. Making a name for himself on the road and at comedy festivals over the past decade, Kondabolu has appeared on every major American late-night TV talk show, is a frequent guest on national public radio shows, and has hosted and guested on numerous podcasts. He has released acclaimed specials with Netflix and Comedy Central, and 3 hilarious and thoughtful stand-up albums. His latest special and record is called Vacation Baby, which was released on April 18th, 2023, and is available to watch on YouTube for free via 800 Pound Gorilla, and to hear on Kondabolu's Bandcamp page. To celebrate Vacation Baby's release and his North American tour dates that bring him to Toronto on June 29th, Hari and I reconnected for a nice conversation about things like his status as a new father and its impact on his working life, fulfilling the expectations of Indian parents and the dietary importance of yogurt in Indian food, comedians who celebrate their cultural backgrounds without mocking them, but also the double standard that BIPOC creators often face when they attempt to discuss things that white creators aren't scrutinized for, the pros and cons of making art that deeply impacts the way other people think and act, his perspectives on his divisive but landmark documentary, The Problem with Apu, and his new friendship with The Simpsons voice actor Hank Azaria, the most meaningful aspects of his work as a stand-up comedian, upcoming tour dates, other future plans, and much more. A part of the Entertainment One Network with the support of listeners like you who follow and subscribe to this donor-driven podcast and spread the word about it and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol. Thank you so much for doing that. It means so much, and it is the primary source of revenue for all the work that goes into this show. There's no other backers or anything like that, so if you like the show and want to see it continue and want to support me financially, please consider doing so at patreon.com/creativecontrol. Thank you so much. Plus, in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario, all wonderful and fine independent businesses, by the way. This is episode 785 of Creative Control, featuring the lovely and talented Hari Kondabolu with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Hi, Hari. How you doing?
It's good to see you, Vish. It's every time I have a project, I know I'm going to speak to you at some point. And a part of me wonders, is that why I make things? Just so we can have these conversations periodically.
You know, I feel the same about you. I think the only reason I do whatever I do is like, oh, Hari's going to have something. I better be ready. No, it's nice. Thank you for thinking of me. I appreciate it.
Man, we always have a nice chat. I'm always looking forward to it.
Yeah. How are things going there? Where in the world are you?
I am in Brooklyn, New York. Things are fine, man. I mean, like, I'm a dad now, so clearly there's a lot going on that has nothing to do with my career. It has nothing to do with, you know, there was a time where I lived and died off my thoughts and feelings, and I've realized that they aren't as important as I thought they were. After the child was born, it's like, you know, those all are second to the million other things this child requires. And the best part of it, selfishly, is like there is something really wonderful, because I've tried to find ways for years to, like, minimize self. Isn't that, like, the goal of Buddhism, right, is to get, and all it required wasn't the meditation, it was just a child. And now the self is so small compared to, the self is a conduit to make sure my kid is okay.
But so that is tied to vocational stuff. I don't want to get too heavy right away, because I totally agree with you. Sorry, just so people understand, how long have you been a father now?
2.5 years, going on 3.
So here's the thing. Those of us who enter our parents of Indian descent might think of as precarious vocational pursuits. As the kids get older and you realize the financial implications of every single thing you do, I don't know about you, but my parents' voice is now louder in my head about, maybe you want to be a doctor. Maybe you should be a lawyer. And I'm like, why were they always like begging me to do this, or insisting even the money? And so then I have two. They're 11, and I want to say 8.
And I want to say...
Sorry, it's a Norm MacDonald joke.
In the ballpark of 8.
Yeah, one of them's 8, one of them's going to be 12 soon. Now I'm like, oh, shit, I'm in the arts. Yeah. Everything's crumbling. They're taking away media from all the things.
One, I'm ready to sell out. That's one big epiphany I had. Like, I never had the same inkling, and now I'm like, I will do what you need me to do.
Yes.
And one. Two, if my child wants to get into the arts, and particularly stand-up, I will not be nice about it. Mm-hmm. This is not something I wish upon my child. And in some weird way, I feel like I want what my parents wanted for me, for him. Like, I go into something with stable income where you can have a family younger and, you know, have more energy and Don't do what I did.
You're becoming your parents. Don't. We become our parents.
And I think that, you know, honestly, like, it's almost, I have a joke in the special. Like, do you realize how hard your grandparents had to work? You know, like, don't waste this opportunity.
The social safety net. The family social safety net.
I mean, and it's not like, you know, with their generation, they had this large immigrant community, right? Mm-hmm. So the safety net's even bigger than you actually think. Community comes in and something happens, the community makes sure you're okay. Yeah. They'll never let you forget that you were in peril. That will be brought up for generations. But like this generation, I won't have the same level of immigrant safety net. Like it goes down with me.
No,
you know.
No, I have recognized my privilege now. I think I'm a bit older than you, Hari, and I've recognized my privilge in this. You know, because I don't know about you, I hear it in your specials. By the way, this new special is just brilliant. I think I've watched it three or four times now. I love it so much. Just beautifully crafted. I want to get into that in a bit, just because I think, like a lot of people who make their living or perfect their art even on stage, you were certainly among those impacted by this pandemic. And I want to talk about that in terms of your comedy, because I pick up on someone who maybe was a little pent up and had a lot of stuff to say, and it's just brilliant. I want to get to that. Where was I going with this, though? Yeah, no, but the parents thing is when you come from immigration, I guess, I don't know how else to put it. My parents came here literally with nothing. And I used to, and then I grew up in that culture clash of being in Canada, and then going when I was out in the world, I was in Canada, and when I came home, I was in India. That's how I used to feel. And did you ever resent that cultural clash yourself? Because I realize I was an ungrateful child in that regard, that these people sacrificed everything, and I was like, fuck off, I don't want to do all this shit. Did you have any of that?
In certain ways, in very specific ways, because I, you know, growing up in New York and just having the so many South Asians around me, like part of me was like, well, everyone's going through it. A lot of people are going, it's not as, you know, but it's the things that I was always kind of hung up about. Is like, I don't want to eat Indian food.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how come everyone gets to eat spaghetti? So I want spaghetti. Yeah. So my parents would make my mom would make a second meal for me and my brother. That was like garbage American food. Yeah. Like, she's making this South Indian meal for her and my dad. And I'm like, no, the kids want SpaghettiOs. So let's give them Chef Boyardee. Like, it was just kind of ridiculous kind of stuff. And then as I got older, my brother ended up enjoying eating South Indian food. And it was only I that had the garbage American meal as I got older, which is increasingly embarrassing more than I think about it.
Is that still the case for you? You didn't grow to appreciate the – did you develop your Indian palate?
No. I love Indian restaurants and I eat at Indian restaurants. And at home, I don't have the spice tolerance for South Indian cooking, which is very embarrassing.
Yeah, so you're talking about
South Indian cooking is very, very spicy. And I talk about it in the special, but it's like, you know, my mom also, I think genetically, doesn't have a great spice tolerance.
Oh, okay.
My father and my brother do, so that's part of it. But I also just, when you don't eat it enough and you don't love yogurt, like you can't, you gotta like yogurt. Because that's the safety net with South Indian food. Like, your stomach's on fire, but we end with yogurt, and that's, you know, if you don't like yogurt, of course it's going to be horrific.
It's funny. I've instituted several weekly traditions now. One of them is movie night. Friday nights we have movie night, and it came up that we were going to watch Temple of Doom, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. Yeah, and I have been avoiding that one. We have watched Raiders.
It's important for them to see.
We've watched Raiders a couple of times. These are young kids, so their memories, I don't even know if they're retaining everything. And my son, again, we just this past Friday night, we watched Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, which he claims is his favorite one. But I avoided Temple of Doom, both because it's incredibly scary, I thought, for children. But the Indian food scene, the dinner scene, I have been traumatized for most of my... Well, I was at the time. I'm fine now. Everyone relax. I'm okay. But as a kid growing up and that being popular, that was frustrating. To give them some context, we decided part of movie night is to order out. We order takeout. And for the first time in the rotation, Indian food. I said, you know what? You're going to be seeing some things and they're not going to make a lot of sense. We never ate snakes and monkey brains, so we're going to get real Indian food. And we did, and it was delicious. I recommend this place where I live now in Edmonton, Alberta. I never got to tell you that.
You moved to Edmonton. Man, I'm never going to see you.
I know. It's frustrating. Have you ever played in Alberta?
I was going to ask you whether you were going to be in Toronto, because I'm doing gigs in Toronto at the end of June, and I'm not going to see you.
No, I know. It's weird. I always see you when we're in Toronto, and I feel badly about that. But my wife's family is from Edmonton. We got jobs that pay. I don't know if you know about this. It's hard to live, in most places. It's expensive. We can't move around. We had a family of four in a two bedroom, bid on a dozen houses, always out in Guelph where I lived. I lived in Guelph, Ontario, about an hour outside of Toronto. And people from Toronto come in with their money and they outbid you by tens of thousands of dollars on a fixer upper.
Yeah.
It's fucked. So we moved. Anyway, my point was I ordered the Indian food and my wife said, you know what we could have used? You didn't order any raita. And I said, oh, yeah, I didn't order it because the heat was getting to everyone. I'm like, yeah, I'm sorry. I just wanted to tie it back into yogurt. I've never been a big yogurt fan. My mother, oh, it's yogurt. You want yogurt? You want raita? And I was like, no, I don't. But because
as you get old, you realize that's how you survive Indian food. Yeah. It's yogurt. It's all based on yogurt.
It is kind of strange. I'm getting at is, obviously, I relate to your comedy. I sent your special to my sister. I don't know that she's watched it yet. She said she'd get to it. But as an Indian kid, your work has always resonated with me. And I just want to tell you that. I think you know this, right? I was looking at the audience pans at your show at the Bell House, and the Indian folks come out. That's fair to say, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's a certain type of Indian person. Like, I think it's, you know, and I think you understand what that means. It has to be somebody who politically on board, isn't afraid of the phrase white people, which I think a lot of South Asian, I think there is that sense of, like, fear of, like, taking a strong racialized identity or stance on racism publicly. Like, there is the fear of what the penalty is. And I don't even think it's intentional, but the times I hear groans regarding race, it's usually very white crowds or very brown crowds. If there's a mix of everybody, it's fine.
Yeah.
But there's something about that I've always noticed where, you know, if the crowd is mostly black or Asian, I don't hear like, ooh, or, but when it's like brown people, that happens more often where there's a tendency of, oh God, who's around? Like, can we say this? Like, and that, I don't get that with the people that come to see me intentionally and know why they're there. And that's what that special was, because they know what they're getting. And, you know, it's not going to be like Russell, you know, certainly. It's like Russell has a certain like kind of inclusivity and a certain accessibility that I'm not going to have. It's not going to be like Hassan, because Hassan's going to be more pop culture. He's going to talk about politics, but and it's going to be clever, but it's not going to be mean. I'm going to be mean. And I'm going to be sharp and mean. And it's not to say unlikable, though some would argue that, but it's definitely going to be its own thing. And I feel like the people that come to see me, like who've been seeing me for a long time, they know what that is.
What's the line between expressing your pain as a comedian in terms of your cultural background? I mean, sorry, pain and that's not the exact right. I think a lot of comedy is expressing pain by making light of your background and your upbringing and whatnot. You mentioned Russell Peters. I assume that's who you meant, not Russell.
Yeah.
You didn't mean Russell Crowe. Russell Crowe's Indian stand-up bits are not that great.
No, they didn't have the lasting power he expected. No,
we weren't entertained, actually, I think is where I was going with that. My point was, what's the line between sending up and sort of therapeutically going through this background that you've had and you know people in your fan base have, but also mocking it? I think I always remember Aziz Ansari once saying, I wasn't going to talk about certain things. I wasn't going to do the accents. And that's what I think part of the tension that you're talking about in terms of Indian people being uncomfortable with white critique is for a lot of us, I think we spent most of our childhood and teenage years trying to assimilate, trying to fit in with white culture. And then as you get older, you're like, wait a minute, these people, not all of them, but this culture is responsible for so much bullshit. Now I'm angry at them. So I spend like, you know what I mean?
No, I mean, what you're saying is like, let me think it through, because what you're saying is like the core of a lot of it. It's like this idea of white gaze, right?
Yes.
Spelled G-A-Z-E, not G-A-Y, in case people are like, hey, it's white gay people. But this idea of constantly worrying about what they view, and the idea that the eye is always on you. And so, you know, Russell Peters' stuff, when I think I saw it in my, you know, when I was 18, 17, 18, 19, there was a range of feelings. First, it was the pride and excitement of a South Asian having their own, like, half-hour special. Even if it's Canada, it was like, that sounds incredibly insulting.
What
but
the hell?
Yes,
even, why did you just say that, even if
even
it's Canada?
Even though it was Canada, even though it was the minor leagues, to still make it.
A lot of great comedy coming out of Canada, if I might say. Good history here.
but the Comedy Now special wasn't as big a thing in the U.S.,
sure,
sadly.
Right.
So, you know, seeing that was like, whoa, like, this is possible. That was the thing, the idea that he existed, like, you know. And the accents are incredible and funny, and it's speaking to us in a way that, like, you know, like the jokes we make when our parents got together for parties and it was a bunch of random, like, South Asian kids who only knew each other at these parties that their parents would go to, and we're making fun of our parents in the back room or whatever. Like, it felt like watching that in this beautiful way.
Yeah.
And then you start thinking, well, what are white people going to do if they see this? Hmm. Is this what they're going to do, what they do with Apu, right? Like, is this going to be the next thing that taunts us? And all of a sudden, I see that and I'm like, what does this mean? This is going to hurt us eventually, you know?
Yeah.
And now, looking at, like the bigger context with time and being in it myself for 20 years, it's like, one, you see why Russell was a pioneer, because he was the first to break through. The first to show people that there is commercial viability, which seems silly to say that he has to prove it for a whole group of people, but that's how racism works, right? That's how groundbreaking works. Like, oh, this one can do it, so others can do it. You know, like the idea that it was even possible didn't seem like a thing. The fact that he, through the internet, it spread globally. The fact that he, if you look at those audiences that, yeah, especially on those early specials, like they're brown people, they're South Asian, they're East Asian. Like, the audience he's playing, like, once it goes online, it's everybody. But it was those audiences he was playing to.
Yeah.
And those are the audiences that, like, lifted him around the world. So if you look at him in that context, like, what he did, I mean, he's still, in so many ways, the biggest South Asian comic in the world.
Yeah.
Like, Aziz is obviously, you know, he, you know, TV star and some film and stuff. But, like, it's not the same.
No.
Globally, like, it's Russell Peters. Like, he's the reason there are stand-up markets around the world, because people saw him play and they started doing stand-up, whether in India and other places. Like, he was their guy. He's that kind of figure. So looking at it now, I view it a lot differently than I did when I was 22, 23. I also think that there's been this fear of, if I talk about my parents, if I talk about my background, immediately I'm going to be pigeonholed. I'm going to be boxed in, right?
Yeah.
And I definitely felt that. And I avoided talking about my family for a very long time for that fear. And then all of a sudden, you know, because I hear the white comics say, of course that's what he's going to do.
Yes.
Of course that's what he's going to do. Even if I didn't use an accent, it was like, of course that's his angle. And then after a while, you realize all these white people are talking about their white parents.
That's a lot of...
Because they're their parents.
Yeah.
You know, like, you start to realize they're doing impressions of their parents, and they're talking about it's the idea that, oh, they can't do what we're doing, and because our parents have this, because they can't use, it's that idea of we can't do, they can say it, why can't we say it? So we have that, and it's like, oh, we're being told we can't use it because of it. We're not doing anything wrong. We're talking about our parents.
Yeah.
And then in terms of accents, it's like there's also a difference between an accent, and this is a trickier line that I'm certainly, you know, my feelings have evolved in. If you do an accent well, if it's done with accuracy, if it's important to the character, it feels unfair that you can do your Jewish mother, you can do your Irish father, you can do all this stuff, but you can't do your Indian parents. If it's done well, if it's done in a way, like, you know, there's a difference between, oh yeah, this person was educated in Bombay boarding schools versus, like, that's Apu. Like, there is a big difference. There is no single Indian accent.
Yeah, there's, and I think I'm of both minds of this. I once did a TV audition in the last 10 years, and they asked me to do a monologue. So I wanted to tell the story about my dad on a recent trip to India, went and got us, for some reason, I didn't ask for this, matching knockoff Umbro tracksuits.
Hilarious.
Amazing. So I wrote up the story and the best I could, just trying to imagine my father even in the bazaar thinking this was a great idea. And I presented it, and when I was done the audition, one of the producers was like, "That was great, but when you tell your dad side of it, why not do the accent?" And I was like instantly offended by this. Maybe I had Aziz's voice in my head, because I grew up doing the accent. I was playing the, playing the room in grade 7 and 8. I knew that if I othered myself, they couldn't do it to me. I was basically Eminem in 8 Mile most of my childhood. I'll do it to myself. They can't do
I'll
it.
Do it first. And yeah. Then, but the thing you realize is, you know what? They still do it.
They still do it.
It doesn't actually cut them off. Yeah.
They do. But my mother, when she talks to me and says strange things, there is a humor in the lilt of the accent.
Yes.
Like the way she delivers a line. Like when I was a kid, I needed glass. I didn't get glasses till grade 9. And when I went to the, and I went once when I was 4 years old, and the optometrist in grade 9 said, "What the hell? You should have been wearing glasses since you were born. Your one eye is so messed up." And when I said to my, I would say to my parents, "I can't see the chalkboard. I'm having trouble. Can we go to the eye doctor?" And my mother would say, and I won't do the accent now, but my mother would say, "Vishal, we don't wear glasses. Like, as a people, as a family, we don't wear glasses." She thought it suggested diminished health or something. Like, I'm trying to read it.
We don't, as a people. You mean just in the family? Because Gandhi would argue
that's
otherwise.
That's what I thought. One of the most popular round glasses wearers of all time, Gandhi, wore glasses. We don't wear glasses. But when
he just wore them for style. It was a look. It was the image.
With the loom, it looks good. But my point is, the way she said it to me and the way I've told the story, I've taken the accent away. It does feel a little less funny because there's something about the attitude of the delivery. Do you know where I'm coming from? Now I'm conflicted. Yeah. I don't want to delve too hard into this, but the thing is, you tell so many amazing stories about your parents. Like the segment in the new special about your mother suggesting names for your child is hilarious. It's amazing. And you show a little bit of discipline by not, you know, exactly mocking your parents.
I mean, there's a slight, because pronunciation wise, you don't want to like completely, you know.
Yes.
You know, I got to try to get the voice requires a certain way to, certain sounds.
Yes.
Right? If you're going to get the name right. Yeah. Like, my name is Hari, you know. Yeah. I could use, what am I supposed to say? Like, so I'm Hari. No, I'm Hari. Even I'm not completely saying it the way they would say it in India, obviously, just because of my voice. But I think it's, to me, if the joke is strong enough, and it doesn't need it, you know, what's the point? And if it does need it, then it wasn't a good joke, you know? Yeah. Like, if what the accent adds is, like, these people sound ridiculous or they're not as smart as I am, you know, then it's like, what is the benefit of it? But it's tricky because, like, when you do the accent well, it takes you right there.
Exactly, yeah.
But it takes you right there is a different thing for someone who grew up with brown people and someone who didn't.
Yes.
Like when I hear it and it's done well, it takes me right to the memories we were talking about of like our parents and us making fun of them and stuff. But for other people, it takes them back. Oh, the guy at the store or the guy that, you know, was a friend of a friend's father or some ridiculous thing that isn't really part of your regular experience. And that's when it becomes tricky. Like, is that accent serving the purpose of realism in your story, or does it end up becoming another one of a handful of racist tropes that someone who's inexperienced with our people can now draw from?
Yes.
And it's unfair. Yeah. It's an unfair thing. And that's another thing that it's taken me a while to get to. Like, it's unfair that we have to make those choices creatively, because I feel like as an artist, like, you should have the option. I know comics who do those accents extremely well. And when they put it up on stage, I have to think to myself, like, man, that's an incredibly well done performance. And I'm nervous about what that could do.
Yeah.
Like how people are going to take it. And at the same time, I've seen people do it. And I'm like, that's a terrible impression. No way your mom sounds like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No way your mom sounds like Hank Azaria's impression. Like, there's no way.
Yep.
Do you know what I mean?
100%.
It just doesn't, like, that's Because my impression is basically an impression of Hank's impression. You know, like, I don't know. I don't do a good Indian accent.
Yeah.
I just don't.
Yeah. No, it's a fair point. And I'm glad you invoked Hank Azaria because for those of us who followed your comp, I don't know. I'm going to ask you this question. I'm going to let it sit here because I don't know if you think of your career as having a kind of before the problem with Apu trajectory and an after, a post.
I do.
Absolutely. Okay.
And it's frustrating, but the reality is like what my career was before and after is completely different and for better or worse. Yeah.
Let's get into that because I think those of us who followed your comedy before that documentary came out, which by the way, I don't know if you know this, Hari, but I love that documentary. I gave it a very nice review in a Canadian magazine and I wrote about it in a more personal way. Than I would normally, but I mean, maybe that's obvious to those of who have heard us talking about our upbringings. But prior to the documentary coming out, I think I thought of you as a very outspoken comedian. You would delve into the same stuff we've just been talking about in terms of racism and also cultural clashes, collisions, these sorts of things. But let's talk about that before and after. How would you describe both to some extent? What has happened to you as someone who I think is now almost predominantly known for speaking out and for talking about this kind of thing? Sorry, this has now become a leading question. Can you talk about this a little bit?
No. I mean, before that, I certainly was less known as a figure. I did fine on the comedy in the comedy world, but I wasn't as I got bigger because of the. I'm yawning while talking about this because I'm bored of the topic of Apu.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to bore you.
No. It's just that, you know, it's... And talking to you about it also is a very different experience than talking to somebody else just because we also have, as a brown person, shared history and who...
Yes.
You know, I can actually talk about with depth, so it's different.
Yeah.
But I think... For those of you for people who knew my stand-up, one, doing the documentary wouldn't have been a surprise that I would have done this thing like that. And two, it's a much softer documentary than what my stand-up historically has been. Stand-up is a little more aggressive and brutal than what that documentary was. That's a pop culture documentary about, like, a cartoon character, but it doesn't delve into the depth of racism like I normally would want to. And, like, it certainly wasn't the documentary I intended to make either. You know, I wanted to make something where I wasn't a central figure in it. I didn't want to center myself in it. I wanted it to be about, you know, the history of that accent, but also the history of, like, minstrelsy
yes.
in this country and the hazing process that, you know, people of color have to go through. So, and I wanted it to be like a bunch of interviews cut together with me maybe being a voiceover. But once you sell it to like a cable network, like, you know, that's not going to work. Yeah, I got 40 minutes to an hour to make something, and the programs around me are prank and magic shows. So,
right.
You know, it's a different kind of vehicle. You're not making just an art documentary. And so, you know, it certainly got watered down for what I wanted to do, though it was a lot, you know, it still was, for me, it was an interesting process to creating a thing, but it certainly wasn't like interesting in terms of the pure content. You know, most of the stuff I knew already. It's not complicated. The idea of having to prove to people that this character is racist, has racial overtones, is obvious. Like, the idea that I had to even prove that in a film is almost, like, insulting in a way. You know, if you actually grew up with it, it's like, why does this need to be proven? I mean, literally, listen to the character. Do I have to explain why this is weird? Yeah. You know?
The character who ran and... I don't even know if the character is still. I know they revoiced people, but he ran a convenience store.
They haven't used him again since, really, just to avoid trouble. Yeah.
And I want to get into that. Like, I appreciate that this might be boring, but it's interesting, or rather tiresome is maybe a better word for you. However, you did something that altered the culture and a cultural institution. And to me, having not talked to you about that, it's quite fascinating.
No, we should talk about it. Yeah. I mean, what's interesting is I don't think I understood how much impact it made until, you know, me and Hank spoke. And that's been kind of great. Like, I've become friends with Hank Azaria, and the work he's done on himself post the film is kind of extraordinary. And in addition to publicly speaking out about how, like, I don't think I should voice his character, South Asian should be in the room, he's done a lot of work on himself with regards to like anti-racist trainings and like being a white ally and actually speaking to groups of white people and trying to explain how, you know, representation works and how the history of race in this country has worked. And, you know, he's been working with different organizations. I mean, it's pretty great. And he's actually gotten more out of the film than I wish, you know, than a lot of people have. It's weird that he's the one who's gotten the most out of it, because that wasn't the intention. But, you know, the Simpsons kind of didn't really do anything with the character, and it just kind of hid from it. And it's frustrating, because I end up in the situation where people are just telling me I killed a character. You want to get rid of this character. I'm like, I don't give a shit about this character. Like, yeah. The story, like, what, like, nobody really watches The Simpsons anyways, what I thought, until I realized, like, oh, around the world they still do, because I get death threats in Spanish and Portuguese now.
Oh, man.
But, like, you know, like, I think it's really cool to see, like, the journey he's taken and the fact that this thing has this bigger life. Sorry, I lost track of where you were.
Well,
I'm sorry.
I think I was asking about the fact that you had a cultural impact as well. So,
talking to Hank about it, you know, Hank has told me, like, you know, like Carl, the character Carl, like all the minority characters in The Simpsons are now voiced by people of color.
Right.
They make Carl Carlson's background that he was the adopted son of Scandinavians, and they made him more interesting. They've built these backstories, and he's like, you know, all those things have happened because of your documentary. Like, all these new lanes that have never been opened have been opened because of your documentary, because they were forced to. And he's saying that these are, like, incredibly good things. The fact that, you know, all these actors have gotten work that deserve to get work to begin with is because of your documentary. And, you know, I think hearing it from him and how it's impacted even that show, you know, that feels good. Certainly, it's not the intent. The intent was really to talk about this as more of an academic thing. You know, it became an activist-y kind of thing, which wasn't the point of it. It was more of an interesting phenomenon, and also discussing during these changing times where we have so many more brown people, this is where we came from. This is what the root is. But I guess it had a lot more impact than I ever imagined.
What about your impressions of each other, you and Hank? Hank, in a recent conversation that was shared, I think someone got you two together to have a chat about this, and he suggested, Hank suggested, well, I thought you were kind of a gotcha journalist, a gotcha comedian. I didn't want to take part in it. He's since evolved, and I wonder if your impression of, and you've just expressed maybe, the thing is, it was called The Problem with Apu. The Problem.
Yeah.
And that, yeah. I appreciate what you're saying about how you didn't expect anything to change. But usually when someone identifies a problem, they're hoping that it can be resolved or solved. And the initial response from the Simpsons camp, I can't recall what Hank said in the early days. Actually, it might be part of your film. But they were like, basically, we're not, this is bullshit. They mocked you on the show with a scene. But now you're saying they have evolved over time. Do you have any perspective on the denial, the anger that they expressed in the early days, not Hank necessarily, but the fact that they did come around, and that is connected to your movie. Come on, man. Like, I feel like like you started something, whether you like it or not, you know? Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. I mean, sure. I mean, like, I mean, it's sure, man, but like, I got to do all this shit so some white people change a character, or I gotta do all this shit so white people hire people of color. Like, it just seems like it's just annoying. I have to do all this shit so people understand a clearly racist character is racist. Like, you know, it wasn't the intention, first of all, but secondly, it's like, it's annoying. Like, I'm as proud as I am of that, it's like, you know, in X number of years, this is all gonna feel absurd, you know, to more people, because it's like, really, that's not obvious to people. He had to make a thing,
but I think a lot of art does this. When you talk, as you know, Hari, I talk to lots of musicians who write their own songs, and some of them will, in an artful way, cover a sociocultural or sociopolitical topic in a song.
Yeah,
and when I talk to them in the moment, they'll say, and I'll say, like, you know, do you think? I was just dealing with this with a fellow named Joe Casey. He plays in a band called Proto Martyr. It's a punk band from Detroit, and he writes beautiful, smart lyrics. But it's subtle. Like, I think I know what's going on, and Joe's been very forthcoming with me on this show. So we delve into stuff, and I go, "Aha! that is kind of what you were getting at, or, oh, I'm surprised by that, but that was your intention. Do you think this song or this album might impact the world? And of course, he's not a pretentious asshole, so he says, no, it's just a song. I'm doing my best. But it's got me talking and thinking, and it's got his fan base talking and thinking. And over the course of history, people will put something in a play or a movie or a song, and it may be mocked, it may be ridiculed, but then it's a pattern of behavior where, like, 5-6 years later, someone's like, you know that fucking movie that came out about the problem with Apu? I think it's right. And it's just incremental change. I don't even have a point here. I'm just saying, I appreciate you saying it's annoying. I want to say on behalf of myself and other people who I think you were maybe aiming the movie at, Indians who went through this shit, thank you.
Sure.
And I think...
I appreciate that.
I think it worked. I don't know if that was your intention, but I think it's actually talking about these things sometimes does happen. It does work. Does that make sense?
I get that, but let me try to think of an example. Like, let's say David Johansen, I mean, and this might be the case to a lot of people, is just Buster Poindexter to people.
Yes, he's not in the New York Dolls. Yeah.
Not New York Dolls, not all the other things he does. He's just that guy with the hot, hot or whatever, right?
And
that was a fun side project he made, but I don't think he assumed it was going to be this thing, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And so to a lot of people, that's who he is. And at some point you deal with it, you come to terms with it. But you know that, like, the depth of his work, that can't even touch what he's, you know what I mean? And that's probably true with a million, like, you know, I remember reading an interview, I think it was with one of the guys from Fountains of Wayne, after Adam Schlesinger passed. I'm blanking on the other singer's name, but he was talking about how, you know, there was a discussion when they made Stacey's Mom.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, this thing is going to go out and it's going to be a thing and we're going to be known for that. And all the other stuff we did, no one's going to know. No one's going to care about. That's going to be our defining thing. And that's a thing we just have to come to terms with. It kind of feels like that. Like, I didn't think this was the difference is I don't think I knew this was going to be the defining thing. I knew it was going to make some impact because no one's ever really criticized The Simpsons. I knew it would be part of some conversation. I didn't know how that conversation was going to look, how more than anything, the thing I learned was how the internet truly works and how conversations work and how you don't need to see a film to make a headline. Like, all this stuff that's what I learned more than anything else from this process. It was the after the film. But you make all this other work, and the work you, like, the stuff I am writing now is about the role capitalism plays in, you know, kind of the conversation we were having earlier. What role does capitalism play in the art you construct, like, as a father? Like, how do I view art now compared to before? Or how does kind of money play into our values, whether it's a prison industrial complex or, you know, whether it's something like Urban Outfitters being this conduit to, you know, of a right-wing billionaire that all of a sudden has this money that's going to anti-left-wing causes and we're all buying our skinny jeans there. Like, it's the use of money in a quote-unquote democratic system and what that leads to and how our values are corrupted. That's the shit I find interesting. The idea of this accent is racist, this character is racist, I found that interesting when I was 16. And I talked about it in stand-up. And I did a short film about it in 2009 when I was, not 2009, 2006, when I was 22, 23 years old, called Manoj. It was a 12-minute short film that covered the topic as thoughtfully and artistically as it should have been covered. It did it in 12 minutes and, you know, it was a lot more subtle. It was a lot funnier. It was a lot more, to me, like, just joke, like, laughs per minute and just the art of it. It was a really funny 12-minute mockumentary that did the job. That's where the conversation for me creatively ended. Like, honestly, like, after that point, after 2006, all this other stuff is the unfortunate result of we didn't exist to the mainstream popular culture until 15 years ago. So there's all this catch up. And so the things I truly wanted to do, I couldn't do back then. So, okay, I did this piece on Kamau Bell's show because, you know, no one's ever covered it. And so I did it. And after I did it, Aziz did his own version of that on his show, and that became a thing. And then I did this documentary because it's like, well, people seem to be interested. Let's dig deeper into it, and I can talk. You know, for me, the thing I found more interesting is to talk about how there's a lot of people that share this idea, that it affected them, and also to talk about Satyajit Ray. Like, honestly, I wanted to talk about the Apu trilogy. I wanted to talk about the rich history of that filmmaker and of Bengali cinema, and how, like, there's something deeper than this stupid cartoon.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, to me, like, the idea that I'm 40 and still talking about this bullshit, you know, it's frustrating when it's like my creative goals are so much bigger than what I wanted at 16 and what I thought about at 16. And the things I care about now are so much bigger than that stupid show.
I think you seem to be lamenting the hit single, if that makes any sense.
And on one hand, I'm grateful because I know it has impacted a lot of people.
Yeah.
I know that it's in curriculums in colleges and high schools. I know that it spurred a lot of great conversations. I see the work Hank's doing, and I'm, you know, part of the conversation I had with Hank in private, but also on Code Switch was like, I appreciate the work you're doing, and it feels good to know that I contributed to that. And at the same time, I was frustrated that when you were doing interviews talking about how you've reconsidered all this stuff, you never mentioned me in the documentary.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like, I took the bullshit for it. I got the death threats. I had the extra security it shows, but you got to be the white guy that learned something. But you didn't say where you learned it, which is, for me, was... You know, initially I'd been like, well, it's part of a greater movement. But, you know, after a while, it's like it's aggravating. It's like, no, I'm a professional whose career is affected by it for better or worse. And I'm a person of color who, as much as I'm getting props for talking about this shit, you know, people of color talking about race and affecting people's businesses, which is what The Simpsons is. It's a business.
Yeah.
Doesn't always feel good for other executives and people with money. Is he going to cause trouble again? Is he going to affect another one of my businesses? The Simpsons isn't just art. It's a multi-billion-dollar industry. It's all over the world with dolls they sell, dolls that are sold out of context of the show with an Indian accent and these characters. Like, it's a multi-billion-dollar business. So when you're fucking with people's money, there's going to be other people that don't want to work with you as a result. So, you know, like, at the end of the day, am I grateful for what it's achieved? Sure. Am I frustrated? Absolutely. But I also know careers are long. I have a lot more to give, and you just keep working. That's a long answer, Vish.
No, that's really an appropriate one. Earlier, I thanked you, but I also now want to express my sorrow that I'm happy that you took a moment, at least a moment, to talk about the experiential impact of one putting themselves out there. So I just want to say thank you and sorry that you're going through any of this. It sounds like it's impacted you on multiple levels.
It's frustrating. I mean, I'm coming to terms with it more. And you know, Vish, you saw it, like, as somebody who saw my career before that point and the stuff I was working on, maybe you see it differently, but this didn't seem like the trajectory for me. Like, to talk about this cartoon character becoming this all-encompassing thing. Like, the stuff I talked about, certainly identity was a major part of it. But, like, I was, you know, those first couple of records I put out, like, that wasn't the center of it. Like, that Bobby Jindal thing that I did in the second record, that certainly was not about identity alone. It was about this bigger idea. And if I was talking about identity, it was in this larger political context. Or I was talking about colonialism, and I was talking about, you know, that Jonathan Swift healthcare joke about eating rich people, like, that's the shit I like. You know, an 8-minute joke about Andy Warhol that, like, you know, just basically runs into itself at the end. Like, that's the kind of stuff, you know, that I'm interested in. Like, the artists I'm, you know, in awe of are, like, you know, Paul Mooney and Pryor and Carlin and Stuart Lee, who's both, in terms of how he writes, what he writes, like, these are the big influences.
And you said it yourself. Yeah, your comedy was sharper and more pointed than the documentary. And I mean, that comes
it's a fucking cartoon. It's about a cartoon.
But Vacation, you know? Baby has the same tone. I will say that. And I, in the time we have left, I want to talk a bit more about that in a moment. But I do want to say one thing. For those who haven't seen it yet, Hank Azaria has appeared in the trailer for the new comedy special, which is nice.
Yes.
And you did that podcast, I believe, together recently. So you were saying earlier you wish he'd actually been more outspoken on your behalf on some level, to be like, yeah, you know what? All this growth really emanates from me actually thinking about what this fellow was saying.
It was a cosign I probably needed very badly when I was getting a bunch of shit.
Has it helped?
You know?
Has it helped since the trailer and his other, the podcast?
I mean, at this point, it's, you know, the trickle of hate I get every week is not going to stop, you know. But during the big rush of it, it would have been useful, you know. But
in this day and age, he's probably getting it now. For even speaking on your behalf, you know?
Yeah, he's getting the, like, sold out cuck, yeah. Same stuff, you know, he's getting the other side of it, yeah. Like the modern version of Race Trader, right?
Yeah.
So I like Hank a lot, and I respect Hank a lot, and I think the journey that he's gone on, the fact that he's willing to back it with actual work, you know, like, it does mean a lot. And I think I went into meeting him with a great deal of cynicism, a little bit of hope, but cynicism. And I've left it with a friend. And I see him as somebody who actually, like, he means it. Yeah. And he's learned a lot. And he gives a shit. And he's still learning. Yeah. And he's still, you know. And I think also talking to him about him being somebody in recovery as someone who's, you know, dealt with substance abuse and is in AA and how he sees this process of learning about race and educating as part of that larger process of atonement and about growth and apology. It's really beautiful, actually, to kind of see that lens applied to race.
And the problem with that show, if I may be on the accent, is, and I don't know if he would have seen it this way, is that basically every single character is a little bit dumb, if not extremely dumb.
Yeah.
So every other character Hank plays, whether it's Mo or the myriad of them, they're all dumb. So I just wonder, they're being ridiculed for their idiocy. That show, you know, sorry, if you think about where we're at as a culture and how we process information and who we take seriously, a good chunk of us, one of our idols growing up was Homer Simpson, an idiot.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were watching the Simpsons movie on that aforementioned movie night, and my son picked it. He'd seen it before, but at this age, now he's a bit older, he's like, everything happened because of Homer. Like, I don't know if you've seen that movie, but he causes, like, an environmental disaster, and it's all because of him. And he somehow, there's always this moralistic, like, he makes up for it, but it's like, no. My son was like, this guy's dumb. He fucking ruined the planet. I mean, he didn't swear. He ruined the planet. So I guess what I'm saying
is, I like that about him, because he's the average American, right? He's the one that's, like, completely self-absorbed I love that. And the thing is with Homer, like, people say, well, doesn't that parody the average white person? I'm like, no, it parodies the average American. That's the thing. Like, he's allowed to be with Apu. We don't get that. He's not like, this is representing the average person that works in retail. That's not the take we're getting.
Yeah, but,
you know, we're getting this very narrow swath.
We've had a weird wake-up call about media literacy with Trump. Like, and reality TV. Like, the people who are famous and idolized are generally vapid and dumb. And I'm saying is, and I'm going to get hate mail. Growing up, Homer was like a benchmark of how to behave socially. To play dumb.
Did you think that? I never thought
I didn't. I'm just saying, I do think people related to the fact that he wasn't smart, and you could get away with that.
That's
there was a charm to his idiocy, and it permeated everyone's, like, how many of us, I don't know about you, we all went around being like, no! Like, just like, you know.
Well, and Lisa wasn't considered a likable character,
exactly. Right. And she was supposedly the sort of moral, intellectual center of the show. But frequently her episodes were kind of a drag. Even for me, I believed everything Lisa was saying. But I'm like, oh no, Lisa.
Yeah.
Oh no, this isn't going to be as fun.
That's why it annoyed me when The Simpsons used Lisa as a way to insult what I was saying.
That was really bad.
I'm like, fucking Lisa would agree. If you were, honestly, it would have been better if Lisa saw my point of view and then Homer or another character, like, insulted her. That, to me,
Marge.
Marge would be willing to, would have been willing to listen, but then wanted to avoid trouble. But Lisa would have just said it. It doesn't make sense that Lisa would have done that. And I say this as a fan of the show.
Yeah, no, I think it was purposeful. It doubled the mockery that the two most empathetic and likable characters.
Yes.
In theory. Anyway, sorry.
And also, which is something I think I had to do to be able to watch the show. If you take that aspect of how the accent's used, how that's a base for mockery, and how that is added onto the jokes, he's a fucking good character. He's one of the more thoughtful. Once you take the conniving immigrant aspect, which was the base of the character early on and still kind of was there, out of it, like smart, deliberate, had to deal with Homer being an idiot like everyone else did, and was like, you know, surrounded by people that weren't as bright and thoughtful and hardworking as he was. Like, there's a lot there. And that clearly
spiritual, but not dogmatic, like Ned.
Yes. But it almost, they had to grow that character from the manure they started with. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
It almost felt like they had to compensate for what he was to make him something greater, to almost cover up for what he was. And, you know, at a certain point, you can only do so much because, you know, and it's also kind of why I feel bummed they wasted, like, you could still build with that character. You can build with his kids. There's a lot to do if you either get another voice actor or just change his backstory. He's a cartoon. None of them age. Like, you can do anything you want.
They kind of took their ball and went home. We're just not going to have him on at all.
Yeah, it's kind of like, come as a, it's a hell of an artistic challenge. And also, they're probably like, I don't want to touch it. I don't want to deal with stuff. That's the stuff you're supposed to touch. The stuff where you feel like you're going to get a hit for it or hate for it. That's the stuff you're supposed to touch. That's where the innovative, scary stuff is. That's the stuff that's good.
When I was watching The Simpsons and Apu was on, and say it was an episode where Ganesh was depicted.
Yeah.
My parents were in the room. They were like, oh, look at that. Like, they were actually vaguely proud that anything was being mentioned. That's an immigrant pain, self-consciousness thing. Like, we are being... It didn't occur to them that it was a mockery in my household.
Oh, I was
too.
You kidding me? They know Ganesha exists. The idea that Homer's offering him a peanut was secondary to the fact he exists.
Yes. And it would be brought up at school the next day.
Right.
For me, you know? So... Anyway, we have really delved into something I wasn't planning to spend too much time on. I want to thank you for your patience with it. I hope we had a good discussion about that.
Always, Vish.
Vacation, baby. I started off saying it's genius comedy. It's genius stand-up to me. The callbacks, the structure. I said earlier that I imagine you were a little pent up from being off stage. Was that the case for you? Were you like, I assume you did a lot of road work to get to the special, but... Were you pent up as a stand-up, not being able to hit the road?
Yes. And also, I wanted to get something out. Like, I felt that so much time had passed since that Netflix special, and the pandemic also meant I wasn't on stage for 2+ years. And I had an hour of material plus that was in the bank that I wanted to put out, and I couldn't put it out because it didn't make sense because I had this kid. And so I kind of wrote this special like in pieces during that 2 years, but couldn't perform it, obviously. And basically spent 4 to 6 months really busting my butt in New York and then on the road for 3 to 4 months consistently to get this special in order. Like, it was the shortest period of time from beginning the process to recording a special that I've ever had. Because normally it's, I was very romantic about it. It'll be ready when it's ready. You know, I have time and we'll do it on the road and we'll see what fits together and when it feels right. I didn't do that for this. I'm like, no, I'm doing this and I'm going to get it done. I set a date that I'm going to film the special. I set the tour dates. I'm like, whatever happens, it's going to be ready by this point. And I'm not going to wait until I feel like, oh, everything, all the things are, you know, all the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed. Like, no, we're not going to be precious. You know, and that was part of also a mentality with being a parent. I'm like, I don't have time to be this precious. The most precious thing is my child. Things have to get done.
Yeah.
And so it was putting a deadline on something and getting it done and feeling really good about the end product. And knowing that, you know, 20 years of doing this plus at this point means that, like, I have the ability to write when pressured to write, I can write and I can write well. And sometimes I need that pressure to get things done. It is the hardest I've ever worked in a short period of time on stand-up. And I think the results did not feel rushed. I look at it and I'm like, this does not feel rushed. This feels like it's together. I put the work in. I wrote every single day to get those punchlines in order. Yeah. The extended version that's on Bandcamp that people can buy, it's 25 minutes longer. I wrote to the point where I had another special in it. You know what I mean? Like, I'm just like, you know, I'm proud of this work. And, you know, even thought about saving that extra 20 minutes and putting it into the next hour. And I thought to myself, no, like, it's done. I'm done with this material. I've done it enough. And now this next hour is a mix of the stuff I had planned to put out earlier that's evergreen, because racism is evergreen and colonialism is evergreen, and new stuff that ties together. And so, you know, it creatively, it was one of the more fulfilling hours because I busted my butt so hard and because I made something out of new experience and out of a very painful, frustrating time. It really was a glimpse of a time period.
I can both, as someone who knows how stand-up works a little bit, I can see all the hard work that you put in. But I also, you have that unique gift that some, a lot of comedians, I think, do have, which is you make hard work seem effortless. And so I want to commend you on that.
Thank you.
I have encountered a thing in recent years, Hari, where people, when something is taken away from them, like road work or whatever else, they lament that they may not be able to do it again. And then when they get to do it again, they're like, ah, fuck, I forgot the shittier parts of this. Yeah, this is kind of a drag. I'd rather, particularly for new parents, they want to, fuck, I was
that
home.
That was definitely there, Vish. Yeah. That was definitely there.
Yeah. So how do you reconcile that as a comedian working in this sort of volatile, this is how you make a living. I get it. But it's a volatile time health-wise, and I assume the crowds are good. Everyone's coming out and all that sort of stuff.
No, crowds have been good. I mean, I think if anything, it has felt when I have a show, I mean, my openers, I think more than anything could speak for me on it. But like, even when I have a show that they say objectively is good, I don't enjoy it enough because I'm like, it didn't go. I wanted it to be like, oh, but I wrote these new jokes that worked, or I've gotten, it's functioning the way I want it to function. Like, there's a part of me that is very much like I'm being impatient about it. I want it to get there sooner because I feel like each one of the times I'm on stage is more valuable than it used to be because I'm away from my family. I don't get to see my kids. So the patience I had before with stand-up of this is part of a process and you just have to sit through it and wait it out and write, I don't have the same patience. And so, you know, I objectively have a tough time looking at a show and being that it's good unless it's something that feels like I really tied a bunch of things together I've been working on. Yeah. I don't have much room for shows where I'm like, yeah, it was like a B plus or a B minus. Like, I don't have the, like, I want it to be worth the trip away from my kid.
But being on the road itself, like physically, it's
brutal. Like, I just don't have the, I'm doing a lot more shows that are like one night, two nights and back home. I'm doing a lot more weekdays. You know, I feel like if I'm going to do weekends, let's wait until it's a bigger tour. I'm doing a lot of cities that I've never done before just to get the practice in. No offense to, like, you know, Woodstock, New York or Brattleboro, Vermont, but, you know, that's not a place that I'm normally going to play, but it's a place where I'm going to develop material and figure out this hour. And then when I feel it's right, we're going to do the, you know, the big tour of all the big cities I love from, like, yeah, New York, Boston, Minneapolis, Chicago, you know, Vancouver, Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, Oakland, LA, you know, all the big ones, you know, Atlanta. But this is like part of the process of developing it. And so I'm just kind of doing it piecemeal because I would honestly rather be home until I have something that is ready to take to the bigger stages and to record.
Yeah. And, you know, it's a good practice city is Edmonton, Alberta.
Honestly, once literally you saying Edmonton, knowing that you live there, makes me want to perform in Edmonton. So I'm straight up. Sweet. I would actually, you know, I played it once before forever ago, and I would play it again. Honestly, knowing you're there, like, it does, you know, all I need is 100 people and a friend, and that's it.
Oh, that's very sweet. Well, I'll make some calls or whatnot. Listen, I'm mindful of the time. You've alluded to a couple of things about the future, about working on a new special, so I assume that's still in progress. If you want to expand upon that, please do, but I assume that's where you're at. You're working on it, right?
I'm working on a new special, and you know, obviously because of the writer's strike, there's certain creative projects that are on hold right now. I'm still developing new you know, TV and film things, and you that's always a process that's ongoing. You hope something sticks. Sometimes people ask, like, you know, when are you going to get into TV and film? And it's like, that's not a question for me to answer.
Yeah.
You know, you're always working on something. You're hoping that it gets through the development process and people actually want to put it out. But as long as people are still interested in making stuff with me, I'll keep putting things out there, you know.
It's interesting how many comedians of your stature, like David Cross, did a special at the Bell House, and he put it out himself. You put yours out free on YouTube. That worries me a little. I know you get some revenue from that, but
no, it worries me too.
This is a Netflix, at least if that's the benchmark right now, or HBO or whatever. This is worthy of that platform, but I assume you tried some of these bigger places.
It was two things. It was one, I didn't want to wait for an okay from them in order to get their money in order to make it, because I was ready to put something out. Two, they're a lot more hesitant now. You know, the market is different. Like, there's a shrinking, right? People are buying each other. There's mergers. It's going back to, you know, there was a golden age, I think, of creating and developing things and going out to the market for writers, comedians, actors for the last 4 or 5 years. And now it's starting to shrink. You know, that golden age is ending. And so stand-up was great during that era because it was easy and cheap to produce relatively. And, you know, people would watch it. And now all of a sudden it doesn't feel the same because, you know, it doesn't make as much money as they hoped. And there's fewer places and, you know, they're being really tight with who they're giving stuff to. And they're definitely being tight with the speed at which, you know, like, I would have had to wait a little bit longer and I didn't want to wait. So then it's like, well, then I will do it myself and I will put the money up myself. And part of me feels good about it because I have control and I'm like, this is my art and I'll put it out. But the other part of me is like, stand-ups already do everything by themselves.
Yeah.
And now we're putting up money for specials. So, you know, it's really a mixed bag, but the markets change. And at this point, I would rather have something out and have people see my work that I'm proud of than have it sit on the shelf forever.
This is fascinating because you're echoing exactly what David Cross said when he was on the show to talk about his latest. But, like, everyone seems to be on the same page with how fucked up the pages are. So that's interesting itself. So, Hari, I want to admit that I did not know there was extra footage on the Bandcamp version of this special. So I'm going to buy that. I'm going to buy that right now because I've been watching YouTube special over and over again. But
it's 20 to 25 minutes. I will say the YouTube thing is definitely a more cohesive and accessible special, like, 'cause I'm trying to lull people in a lot of ways. And at the end, it gets a lot more harder. This special, the gentrification stuff, and on the, I call it Extended Vacation, baby. That's the name of the longer band camp. And the gentrification stuff is pretty brutal, and I loved it, and I wish we included it, but it just didn't fit. And there's a whole bunch of tags and callbacks. There's a lot more creative stuff in there structurally that I didn't include in the special. So if you are a fan of mine, the album version on Bandcamp, I think you'll really like it, Vish. And I'd love to hear what you think after you hear it.
Yeah, I'm going to, as soon as we're done here, I'm going to pick that up. If people want to learn more about you, your tour dates, the stuff we've been talking about, Hari, where would you like to send them using their telephones and computers and whatnot?
Obviously, at Hari Kundabolu at all the social medias. I'm using Instagram more nowadays, and I'm on TikTok, even though it just feels weird for a man my age to be on TikTok. And, you know, YouTube, Vacation Baby, please watch it. Pass it around. It's free. More than anything, I just want people to see it, so pass it to your friends. Share it on the socials. And again, if you go to Bandcamp, you can get all my albums, but the new one, Extended Vacation Baby, you know, if you want to support my work and if you want to hear more comedy from that special, go there. And no pressure. I'm just the father of a small child, but no pressure.
No, I will link to all of these things. No problem there, Hari. I encourage everyone to buy things and watch things.
And I'll be touring, Vish. I'm touring all of June. I'll be touring in the fall and I'll find my way to Edmonton. I'll figure it out.
In Toronto, as we're speaking, you're in Toronto June 29th, I want to say.
That's
off the top
right.
of my
two,
head.
Yeah. Two shows at the Comedy Bar in Danforth. So
I miss the Comedy Bar. I miss Toronto. But that's another time. We can talk about that later. Hari, normally, as you may recall, I'd like to go out on tracks by musicians, by comedians. You have a new record, a new special. If we could go out on something from Vacation Baby to give people a little bit of a flavor of what the special is about, can you think of something that makes sense right now?
Let's do the one. This is a joke that I don't think I realized how much people would like it when people seem to really like it. And I've actually grown to love it even more. The bit about my kid's first nightmare.
Yeah.
Let's do that bit. My kid's first nightmare, my mom's response to it, that whole sequence. Yeah.
Sorry. That's very funny. I appreciate your parenting humor can be a little hack. You've done it beautifully. It's so brilliant.
Thank you very
and
much. Thank
so
you.
Relatable. Okay, so this is a bit about Hari's beautiful child joining us on planet Earth and instantly not really enjoying themselves that much. That's a way of putting it, maybe. I don't know the name of it off the top of my head. I think it's a lot more succinct. We'll go to that now. Hari, it's always a pleasure to speak with you. It's been too long for me, so thank you so much for this, and I wish you the best luck in the future, and I hope we talk soon.
Yeah, definitely, man. Good to see you, man.
Me and my partner have had very different experiences being parents, and it was clear it was going to be different from day one. I remember she was holding the baby in her arms, and she was crying, and she looked at the baby, and then she looked at me, and she said, "This is the greatest thing I've ever created." And I think she wanted me to say me too, but the thing is, I have a Netflix special, and it's so good, like from beginning to end. Joke, wonderful the whole way through, and I just met this kid. The jury is out. People have called my child a COVID baby, which is inaccurate because he was not conceived during COVID. If you must know, he's a Honolulu Ritz-Carlton vacation baby. The pandemic had nothing to do with it. He was conceived as a result of 200,000 Delta Sky Miles. And for Mai Tais. So I think it's fair to assume that the child was unplanned. It was an unplanned pregnancy, and we had a choice to make, and I'm very grateful that we had a choice. What we didn't have a choice in is that we were going to be pregnant during a global pandemic. Do you realize how weird that is? To be pregnant during a global pandemic, there's death around you, despair, no hope, and you bring a child into that? Having a child during a global pandemic is like buying real estate in Pompeii as Mount Vesuvius is erupting. Now, a little bit about that failed punchline. When I originally wrote the joke, the punchline was, it's like buying real estate in Ukraine as the Russians invaded, right? And your reaction is appropriate. It's a comedic concept known as too soon. I understood that. I'm like, don't worry about it. I'm just going to go to 79 AD, destruction of Pompeii by Mount Vesuvius, discovered a new comedic concept called too long ago. So I'm looking for a tragedy in the sweet spot. Haven't quite found it yet, but hopefully before the end of the night I can find a horrific event to use as a metaphor that we can all laugh at together as a family. 9 hours after my child was born, he started twitching, and I got nervous. And I asked a nurse what was going on, and he's like, "Don't worry about it. He's just having a nightmare." A nightmare? He's 9 hours old! What on earth has happened during the first 9 hours? What was he, like, ripped out of the only place he knew his home and thrown into a land of bright lights and giants with no guarantees of food, safety, or shelter, with no real understanding of why he exists? And to be perfectly honest, the giants that run the show, they don't know why they exist either. You know, they're just hamsters running around a wheel, and all they know for sure is that they're cogs in capitalism, a machine they cannot destroy. So what are you twitching about? The nightmare is just beginning. My mother told me that she heard that when babies that small have nightmares, it's because their soul is remembering its previous life. And I don't know why she told me this. Why are you telling me that my son is possessed by a spirit with PTSD? So my child's just like, "My wife, where's my wife? I'm a baby, when did this happen? What'd I miss? Did Vesuvius explode?"
Hold up. Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Man, that is a funny, funny album and special, Vacation Baby. Thank you so much to Hari for being back on the show to talk about it. Love talking to Hari, as you can tell. We have an affinity for one another, it seems. Years of speaking to one another. This is, I think, his third time on this show. Thank you so much, Hari. Thank you so much to all of you listening to this episode. This is the 785th episode of Creative Control, if you're trying to keep track at home, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and is available just about wherever you get your podcasts. If you can't find an episode that you've heard about and you're looking for it, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my monthly newsletter, please visit vishkana.com. You can also like Creative Control currently on Facebook. You can also follow the show currently on Twitter, at Vish Creative, or you can follow me directly on Twitter or on Instagram at Vish Khanna. If you're hearing this and you have an invite for that new thing, Blue Sky, and want to send me one, that would be lovely. I just want to see what if that's better. It's started by the other guy, the same guy who started Twitter, isn't it? I'm a bit confused. But anyway, if you got one, please add me to your list of recipients for the Blue Sky thing. Or if you don't want to, that's fine. I'm just putting that out there at the end of the show. Also, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to sustain this donor-driven podcast. $6 American or more a month grants you access to exclusive content, plus you get the episodes earlier than everybody else does. I still have some Creative Control t-shirts in the burgundy or maroon. I never know the difference anymore. Maybe I never did. I got that design and then the yellow t-shirts in various sizes still, although I'm running low on many of them. Anyway, if you want any of these perks and also just want to support this show financially because you like it and hope that it doesn't go away because I can't afford to do it anymore, please go to patreon.com/creativecontrol. I appreciate it. Thank you. Speaking of thanks, thanks again to Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee, respectively, in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario. All wonderful independent businesses who provide in-kind support for this show. Thanks to my old friend Jim Guthrie for providing me with some music that I use sometimes on the show. You can learn more about Jim at his website there, jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you so much for listening to this episode with Hari Kondabolu, one of the greatest stand-up comedians working today, and very thoughtful and lovely guy who I adore. I hope you enjoyed this episode and this conversation. If you're new to Hari's work, check it out. If you're familiar with it, but don't know who I am, hello, I'm Vish. Hari's been on the show a few times. We're friendly. You can subscribe to this podcast or follow it, these sorts of things, and tell your friends about it too to help spread the word. All right, I'm going to go. I will talk to you soon, I hope. Thanks again. Bye for now.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.